My name is Betty Sargent, and I have the great privilege of being on the board of the New York Society Library. This is our members' room, and a fellow of the Library of America. Imagine that. I mean, my two favorite things in New York are right here together tonight. I just want to welcome you all. We have a wonderful program. And I want to really quickly tell you my little story about Kurt Vonnegut. Many years ago, when I graduated from the University of Michigan with a degree in English, right? I figured, well, what do I want to do? I know, I'll be a book editor. So I went to the Radcliffe Publishing course up at Harvard for the summer. And at that course, they have a visiting author every summer. And so the director, Mrs. Diggory Venn, said, so now I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Kurt Vonnegut. Nobody had ever heard of this guy. He sort of shuffled up to the front of the room, and he said, I'm going to read to you from my slightly weird novel, Cat's Cradle. And it was just an amazing moment in history because he was so unknown. At any rate, we're all thrilled that you're here. I think it's going to be a wonderful program. And I would like to introduce you to Max Rudin, who is the publisher of the Library of America.
Thank you, Betty, very much. On behalf of the Library of America, our president, Cheryl Hurley, and our directors and staff, welcome. And thank you very much to our partner, the New York Society Library. For those who may not know, the Library of America is a nonprofit publisher and cultural institution dedicated to making permanently available authoritative volumes of great American writing. Our publishing program is supported by the Library of America Fellows, our patrons group, kind of our extended Library of America family, and it's terrific to see so many fellows in the audience tonight. Tonight, we celebrate two books, volumes number 216 and 226, in the Library of America series, edited by Sidney Offutt, in which Kurt Vonnegut's dark, funny, eccentric, and wildly imaginative novels and stories take their place with the best American writing. As many of you, all of you, probably remember, in the 60s and 70s, when Sidney got to know him very well, Vonnegut was a literary hero. His books helped set the tone for the counterculture, and dog-eared, much-read paperback copies were a regular feature of dorm rooms and jeans' back pockets, I think you all recall. His immediately recognizable style, a blend of science fiction, philosophical musings, and slapstick humor, fueled by a kind of world-weary moral fury, seemed so much to define and capture the temper of the era, seemed so much a part of that time, that it might have seemed surprising and unlikely that its magic would endure and that we'd in fact be standing here today. But the work remains astonishingly vital. For one thing, his subjects are still our subjects. The banalities of consumer culture, the triumph of technocracy, scientific irresponsibility, environmental destruction. But more than that, it's clearer now than ever, that Vonnegut is a great comic moralist in the tradition of Mark Twain, improvising fables that explore basic questions of human existence. Why are we here? How should we live? Does any of this make any sense? As with Twain, wild humor serves at the same time to mask and to reveal both outrage and despair. And, like his most famous character, Billy Pilgrim, Vonnegut's plots become unstuck from time and reality. They fly off to other eons and galaxies in a way that feels like a symptom of profound trauma, an imaginative response to war and horror and loss. These may be some of the reasons he still speaks to us. There's also that inimitable voice. Plain-spoken, beautiful, funny, humane is how Rick Moody describes it. He sounds like a person, Rick says, and a very warm, interesting person, not a literary voice. Vonnegut is vital, finally, because he's on the minds of vital contemporary novelists like Rick Moody, whose most recent novel, The Four Fingers of Death, is in important respects an homage to Vonnegut. We're extraordinarily fortunate tonight to have in conversation two men who bring different but complementary perspectives to Kurt Vonnegut. Sidney Offutt, who knew him as a friend and working writer, and Rick Moody, who encountered his books as brilliant entertainments, inescapable influences, and inspirations to become a writer. I will turn things over now to Sidney Offutt, an active and indispensable figure in the literary and civic life of our city, acclaimed writing teacher at NYU and the New School, curator of journalism's George Polk Awards, longtime board member of Penn and past president of the Authors Guild, author of 2 novels, 10 children's books, and 2 acclaimed memoirs, most recently, Friends, Writers, and Other Countrymen, which includes anecdotes of encounters with Eleanor Roosevelt and Che Guevara, Jackie Robinson and Jackie Onassis, not to mention Kurt Vonnegut. Please welcome literary raconteur extraordinaire, editor of the definitive Library of America Vonnegut edition, Kurt Vonnegut's best friend and tennis partner, Sidney Offutt.
Well, one thing you know for sure, I'm not going to drop any names. But I have to say, that was an absolutely inspired resume of Kurt Vonnegut's life, wasn't it? It could be called the Encyclopedia of American Literature. Beautifully done. And it's a great honor to be here with Cheryl and Max as our host and to be able to sidekick with a young literary hero of mine, Rick Moody. And also, as I look around the room, I see my old friends, Tom and Alice Fleming. And over there in the far corner is Joel Canaro, who once said to me, "You should never speak in public unless you read a poem, because you should read a poem a day." And would you believe it? I am holding in my hand one of the very rare collections of Kurt Vonnegut's poetry. Kurt did call me his best friend. And it moves me profoundly. And he used to send me a lot of stuff in the mail. I have to say to you, in all honesty, I had no sense of celebrity with Kurt. I mean, I wasn't taking notes on the relationship, and the only reason why I saved everything is because I save everything. I mean, I'm 83 years old. If anybody wants a job, my wife would be relieved. I mean, but I had this collection of poems, and when I thought about Joel's suggestion, I thought, I'm going to read you one just to start, and then maybe at the end I may slip in another. Because one thing you know, if you're reading a Kurt Vonnegut poem, it ain't going to be Paradise Lost. We'll be able to handle it. This is called Worship. I don't know about you, but I practice a disorganized religion. I belong to an unholy disorder. We call ourselves Our Lady of Perpetual Astonishment. You may have seen us praying for love on sidewalks outside the better eating establishments in all kinds of weather. Blow us a kiss upon arriving or departing, and we will climax simultaneously. It became quite a scene, especially if it's raining cats and dogs. Well, there's a Vonnegut poem, and you heard it, and it's one of this collection. It is one of the aspects of Kurt that I suppose many of you are aware of. He was an enormously diversely talented person. You're aware of that. I mean, earlier this evening, a charming gentleman was telling me about him signing books, and he used to do little drawings in the books. And he really was an artist. He loved drawing. He loved art. He wrote plays. He greatly enjoyed writing poetry and short stories. And he brought to it that great diversity. I'm always fascinated by the extraordinary, iconic figure he was to young people. And as I look at all you young people out here, the ages of my children, I know. Because it was actually my sons who introduced me to Kurt. I mean, not to him personally, but to his work. And I'll quote my younger son's line. To me, he said, "I think this book is the best book I've ever read." And he said, Slaughterhouse-Five. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know Kurt Vonnegut." And then he said to me, "I didn't ask if you knew him. I asked you if you read the book." Boy, that put me in my place for the next 50 years. But I think that is a very valid way to start this evening's discussion. I'll tell stories and read excerpts from his letters maybe as we progress. But I think it would be just great to hear Rick Moody's reflections on how he first became introduced to Kurt's work and how it played through his life. So I'm going to pass it on to Rick to kick that one around. Okay, Rick?
Thank you, Sidney. I'm really happy to be here, too. Honored to be invited by the Library of America. And now I know I'm 2 degrees separated from Che Guevara, which is really... I hadn't known until now. So, how did I come to be interested in Kurt Vonnegut? I was trying to come up with an excerpt to read, and I reached intuitively for this book, whose jacket everyone will remember from the 70s, Breakfast of Champions. It came out in 1973 when I was 12. And I didn't actually get it that year, but I got it soon thereafter. And the way that I came to it is simply that I was a precocious reader, like many eventual writers are. And I had spent sort of 11 and 12 reading from tip to stern every single word of Ernest Hemingway and all of Robert Heinlein, which is a really bad pairing of writers, but in a way, not an astonishing pairing for someone who then quickly moved on to devour every book by Kurt Vonnegut. So I came to Vonnegut because kids that I knew, the sort of bookish chess prodigy middle school type kids who read science fiction, said to me, "You should totally read this book, Slaughterhouse-Five. It's really incredible." And I sort of dawdled on it a little bit, and I think I may have polished off The Lord of the Rings and The Interim and so on. And then my sister, I think, had this book, and I loved the jacket, you know, so I just figured I would wade in. Plus, it had pictures. Really incredible when you're 12 to have pictures. So I tried it out and instantly devoured it without any hesitation at all. And part of what was incredible to me was not only the sort of very counterculture feeling of handmade drawings and text, but the incredible warmth of that voice. I mean, Max already read what I said about it, but that was really my reaction, that as a sort of literary artifact, this voice was incredible, because it was like having a really wonderful person sort of whispering in your ear, and not in an elevated way, but in a way that was totally accessible to me as a reader at that age, you know. So that was really an important part of that discovery. And then the sort of odd mix of realistic detail, Midwestern detail in this novel, and, you know, sci-fi weirdness came really easy to me. I mean, we now look back on a book like this and it actually seems sort of experimental, like an experimental artifact of some kind. But I think readers who came upon this work at first sort of drank it in as completely consonant with the kind of social weirdness of 1973 to begin with. So I didn't have any problems with Midwestern locale plus Kilgore Trout and all that kind of craziness. It all sat together nicely for me. And having finished this book, I then went and read, I think, six or seven of them right in a row.
Well, you know, I have to say this because it Kurt has written it. That sci-fi thing really drove him a little nuts. Did you know that? He wasn't crazy about being it. In one of his books, he even mentioned the science fiction is like putting you in a drawer and wrapping you out. Because the nuance of it is that you're not considered a serious literary figure. And I have to venture into stories. We were once discussing that, and I said, "Hey, Kurt, did you know I was an editor at a magazine of fantasy and science fiction?" He said, "Doesn't surprise me. You seem to have done everything." He said, "What were you doing there?" I said, "It's a good question." I said, "I was married in 1952, and my wife and I were discovering that I could make a living as a writer." That revelation came very slowly. But so I went for this job with L.E. Queen's Mystery Magazine, and the magazine is fantasy and science fiction. So he said, "And what did you learn there?" I said, "That's a good question." I guess it occurred wrong against any. I said, "Well, you know, we had this long story, and we were supposed to cut it, and there was a gentleman named Anthony Boucher, who was the editor. We never saw him, but he was a very distinguished editor, you know, and he used to edit in absentia, but he used to write for the Times, and he was the authority. And then I thought I had done the job, and then I get back this cut manuscript, and there are five opening pages are missing, and there were the five pages that described how the spaceship went to Mars." Kurt loved that. He was smoking a cigarette. "How did the spaceship get to Mars?" He liked science, you know. I said, geez, Kurt, I don't remember anything from that, not at all. Just that he cut it, because he said, Boucher said, the important thing in a fantasy, science fantasy story, he said, you don't have to build a machine, just have them land on Mars. And then he got off one of those real shots to the gut. He said, the line that the reader is most willing to accept is the first line of the story. Yeah. And Kurt took another puff and said, well, you learned something. So I never brought it up again, but he did have that feeling. Because Rick is such a wide-ranging stylist, I'm sure most of you have read his books, but I was just curious to know, Rick, how do you feel about science fiction? Do you feel as if it's a genre that should be dismissed? Do you think it's fair to call Kurt that kind of writer? How do you respond to that?
I mean, I totally can understand why he would want to avoid being ghettoized as a science fiction writer, because it is a sort of a kind of backwater from which it's hard to transition into being a literary writer. And he really dramatized that with Kilgore Trout. I mean, I think Kilgore Trout, who was the sort of woe-begone science fiction writer in several Vonnegut novels, himself was trying to find a way out of that spot, trying to write his way out without success. And so I totally understand why he would resist that, and I think it would be, you know, completely inadequate from this vantage point to consign Kurt to that spot in any way. But that said, I don't actually believe that genres exist in some fundamental way. I think it's just a bookstore thing. I don't think they do.
Because I think that's right. The genre is not that really important.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a way for sort of people somewhere to kind of have fun splitting hairs about what particular kinds of books are. So the real difference is between literary writing and writing that's not particularly literary. And I associate literary writing with emotional complexity and ambition of a certain kind. And it would be easy, if you were just a completely superficial reader, to think that Kurt was just about warmth and a certain kind of humor or something, and to miss the absolute emotional complexity and literary ambition of his intention, which does rely on Twain, as Max said, and on a sort of American tradition that includes Thurber, perhaps, or Dorothy Parker, you know, writers with great wit. But I feel like there's real novelistic intention in Kurt's work and emotional range. And so on that basis, there's no reason at all to consider him a quote-unquote genre writer. That would be limiting.
Well, I think that's as definitive as you get, but I'm going to add just a footnote. I was always a little self-conscious about this, so I'll share it. Kurt said, and I think he wrote it, so I know it's valid. He thought that one of the reasons why literary people tended to be dismissive about science fiction was because often people who were literary, very literary in their impulses and tastes, weren't too good at the sciences. I mean, I don't know. We're not going to take a vote. But, I mean, I understood that. I mean, I remember, you know, with Johns Hopkins, where I was an undergraduate, the pre-meds were the demons of the school, because everybody was going for the... And the English majors were not messing around with biology and physics. And physics, I later learned... I made a very wise marriage and married a woman who was Phi Beta summa cum laude, who could study everything. And so our sons, one of our sons did study physics for a while. And I understood that there was a vast dimension of revelation in life, almost religious in that dimension. And Kurt had that. Kurt had that dimension of perceiving and responding to science. And I just mentioned that in a passing comment. It's incoherent, but that's what makes good discussion. The other observation was he was very observing of everything around him. And I'll give you this one to go home with. How rarely do you look up at what you're passing by? I mean, look up at buildings. I mean, I'm honest with you. I really didn't do that very much. You know, and whenever I walk with Kurt, he would be looking up. And I've got it in my pocket, because there was one day we were walking up 57th Street. You can test this one. It was across 57th Street, across Fifth Avenue. We walked by Tiffany's, and the building right east of Tiffany's. And he looked up and said, would you guess what that was once a public school? And there it was. P.S., you know, five numbers and four words like honor, boom, boom, boom. And from many times when I'm walking by that, I look up and say, hey, Kurt, because he spotted it. It is a whole dimension. And it's an aspect of the literary craft that I think he definitely brought to it. I want to move to another observation of his and share it and see what Rick thinks of this one. This is, Kurt, a special message to readers in relationship to that the Slaughterhouse Five. And if you have never heard this before, it's worth being here tonight just to get this one. This is Kurt Vonnegut on the Dresden bombing. It's a brief piece. I'm just going to read you four lines. He said, atrocities celebrate meaninglessness. I didn't mount the stage. I went home. That was his line on Dresden. And here it comes. The Dresden atrocity, tremendously expensive and meticulously planned, was so meaningless, finally, that only one person on the entire planet got any benefit from it. I am that person. I wrote this book, which earned a lot of money for me and made my reputation such as it is. One way or another, I got $2 or $3 for every person killed. Some business I'm in. Well, that's a stinger. Okay, I'll drop that one on Rick. Where are you making that one, Rick?
Oh, my God.
Did you all know that? Is that a line for you, maybe? Woo, okay. What's your reflection on it?
Wow, we could talk all night about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I have such complicated feelings about the Dresden image as it plays out in Vonnegut's work, I think. I mean, I think it's utterly central to what he does. I'm sure you would say the same thing, that all the books come from that moment in some way, that the moment that Slaughterhouse Five was conceived with that as its centerpiece, with that as its trauma, if you will, Vonnegut locked into the thing that made him especially great, and he never really looked back from that moment, which is not to say that some of the work before that isn't great, because it is, but from that moment on, he's a absolutely major American writer, and we could sit here all night talking about Dresden itself, and whether or not that was a wise move, or whether the military effort required Dresden in order to be completed, or what have you. But I think what makes it especially useful for readers of Vonnegut is just the fact that there are human faces there, and that the situation in which he found himself, you know, as a sort of friendly fire casualty, or nearly one, since he was part of the Allied forces and nonetheless found himself there at that moment, is incredibly curious and as I was saying before, kind of emotionally paradoxical. But its primary value for me as a reader is just in the fact that a human face has been attached to a great atrocity. And that's as it should always be in literature,
that's
I think.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I'm going to move it around again. Kurt and I were friends. We didn't spend a lot of time discussing literature, but Tom Fleming and I don't, and neither did Joe Connor. You don't really bat it around. You talk about life and things. So I only brought it up with him once when I was teaching at the New School, and this was so long ago, I can't remember what decade it was, and I was going to miss a class. And I went to military school, so secondary school, so I have a great sense of duty. And I said, Mr. Vonnegut, I'm about to impose on you. I said, I have to miss a class. Do you think you could cover it for me? He was always pleased by my mimicries and multi-characterizations. And he smoked a cigarette and exhaled and said, it's possible. I said, well, okay, I'm going to announce it to the class. I'm just curious, Kurt, because you have such an individual style. And this was during an era that was so long ago that the mimicries of style that I would see in class But Salinger was still being, you know, when I say mimicry, I don't think that the student who was writing that often wasn't realizing that this is an imitation and you're not going to go for it. And occasionally you'd see a play at Vonnegut, but nobody who played at it went it through. It was too tough to sustain. So I was curious as to how he would teach writing. I said, how do you do? And he had taught, I think he was either on his way from to Iowa or something. And he said, well, the major thing you teach, he said, is development. You can teach development. I said, yeah. And then he did a chart. I didn't bring that, but it was a great chart. It went all over the place. And I made the big mistake of announcing to the writing class that I was going to miss the session and Kurt Vonnegut was going to be there. And I asked a friend of mine earlier, can you guess the first question? I said, can we bring a guest? Can we bring two guests? How many guests can we bring? And I thought, oh, Jesus. And I was in a cold sweat. I knew I had made a big mistake. You know, if the last thing you want to do is exploit your friend. And I said, what am I going to do? I said, well, and I'm not good at this. That's my weakness. I don't like to hurt people's feelings, you know. And so I said, well, okay, I'll leave it to your discretion. So I thought the only thing I could do was cancel the trip. I'd have to even go with him. I mean, I just couldn't let the guy. And you know what happened. You walked into the hall. You couldn't get to the room. And you know, this guy, he was so enormously modest. I mean, he didn't even pick up the celebrity aspect of it. He made it, I was the star. I mean, he already could read it. I said, no, this is not my class. He was all your fans that are coming out. And he said, no. He said, they love your game. And then it made me very conscious of his, and he spoke, we cut it up together, but he spoke a little bit about the craft of writing with detail. And then I later, in reading for this, for the Library of America, came across this description of the craft of writing, which I'm going to share with Rick, because I'd love to know your responses. This is unfair to spring it on him, but he had 10 rules, and I'll read them to you. This is Kurt Vonnegut. He begins with, now lend me your ears. Here is creative writing 101. One, use the time of a total stranger in such a way that he or she will not feel the time was wasted. Give the reader at least one character he or she can root for. Three, every character should want something, even if it's only a glass of water. Rule four, every sentence must do one of two things, reveal character or advance the action. Rule five, start as close to the end of the story as possible. Rule six, this one is a stinger, be a sadist. No matter how sweet and innocent your leading character, make awful things happen to him in order that the reader may see what they are made of. Like testing the character. Right? Whew. Seven, write to please just one person. If you open a window and you make love to the world, so to speak, your story will get pneumonia. And then the final rule is give your reader as much information as possible, as soon as possible. The heck with suspense. Readers should have such complete understanding of what is going on, where and whether they could finish the story themselves, should cockroaches eat the last few pages, they know where it's going. And that is a tough one. You got a little speculation on this? I don't know.
Let me see that list.
I didn't make that up. There it is. I mean, it's kind of startling, isn't it? I mean, I tried it once in a writing class, and the line that got me was, be a sadist. You know,
there's two things that I like about this list, which is, in the main, totally unimpeachable good advice. But there are two things that interest me. One is number seven, write to please just one person, which is incredible and really important. And it's the thing I say to my students all the time now. I say, do not write for the market. Don't think about the market. Right. Only the practice is important, not the results of the practice. So if you make the work every day and work at it every day, that'll be result enough. But that level of commitment is usually followed by some felicitous outcome. So I totally agree with him about that.
Well, who would you say is the one person you write for? Could you say that?
Rick Moody.
Oh, yeah. I know him. Okay.
But the other thing that's really moving to me, and I read this in your introduction to the
a look at the
to the posthumous stories, is how committed he was to narrative, you know. And if we were to sort of go back and think about Vonnegut novels, Slaughterhouse-Five is completely circular and revolves around the Dresden image, you know, the way a tornado revolves around the cow that it's sort of kicking through the air. So it's in no way a linear narrative and could not be considered a linear narrative. Breakfast Champion of Champions, the protagonist is bipolar or something, at least very mentally ill, and it lurches back and forth between him and Kilgore Trout until Vonnegut himself appears in the narrative, which is the passage I want to read a little later. So on what basis is he saying push the narrative forward? By the time we get to the 70s, the American novel has fragmentation as part of its process. And Kurt lived through that period, and he had something to do with that period. He engendered part of that period. But I think at the same time as that's the case, there's a very archetypal storyteller at work in his writing, and he's keenly aware of the sense of time passing and the kinds of humilities that go along with time passing. So things happen, people change, they get wiser, they go through the travails of life in Kurt Vonnegut, even when you have these incredibly slippery, episodic or strange superstructures.
All right, here's a dirty trick. This is a Rick Moody novel, okay?
That is a dirty trick.
And I'm going to just share this because I thought that this particularly description, chapter 16, description of a house, has such a rich texture to it that it had I'll give you the specific. John Leonard, at Kurt's 80th birthday, talked about his style, and he said that he was like Mark Twain, and he said Abraham Lincoln, he said, because when they were not depressed, they were humorous, he said, and their writing was like jujitsu. They would flip you at the end of the sentence and stun you. This is Rick Moody, and he's the first person narrative. I'm not setting it up because it'll take too long, but it's a description of a place. I'm talking on a dial phone, an old dial phone, 5 pounds worth, and the kitchen is bigger than my entire apartment. You could park trucks in here or feed an army. And the refrigerator, one of those enormous serial killer refrigerators, you wouldn't even have to cut off the arms. Just go ahead and throw victims in whole. The house is so big, I got lost coming downstairs to make tea. I don't know where I ended up. There's a living room the size of a tennis court. A library just as enormous, except it all looks like they got bored with home improvements back around Disco. It goes on. Now, do you get it? I mean, it's got that Philip Judice thing at the end. So tell me, Mr. Moody, where does this come from? Do you find that something coherent with the perceptions of Kurt?
You know, I read that quote before, and I got confused by the jujitsu part of it some reason. But I totally agree with the comic and tragic being adjacent to one another. And I think that's totally central to Kurt's writing, and it's certainly something that I understood even as a teenager when I was reading this work. And I think my personal idea of novel writing is the funny stuff is funnier if there's some sad stuff right next door to it, and vice versa. In other words, there's a dreadful earnestness to some of American naturalist writing because it's completely leached of anything funny. You know, I was reading Flannery O'Connor this week at NYU for my class. Okay. Flannery O'Connor is so devastating because she's so funny in spots, you know. And Kurt is sort of the absolute model for that kind of thing. It's exactly the funniest moments that are the most sad and vice versa, you know. It's a really important lesson because great literary writing to me has to have all those tonal colors. It's like a symphony. You can't have a symphony if you don't have, you know, different tempos. That's part of symphonic structure, you know. And it's the same with a novel. You have to work out each way and prove that you can do the tragic and the sad in order for all of human emotions to be packed into one book.
This kid has just knocked it right out of the park. He's absolutely, I don't think he knew this. Kurt introduced me to Flannery O'Connor's work. Did you know that? He was a great admirer of Flannery O'Connor. A good man is hard to find. Remember the end of that tour? I remember him, because he would understate it. And he said, you've got to read this. And he pushed the book towards him, smoked a cigarette, and then we kept moving. And when he thought Flannery O'Connor was one of the great American writers. It's just as an observation, so your reference is absolutely right on the button. I just want to share a couple experiences about manner, because the literary quality of this has been pretty well defined already, and the personality of somebody that I don't think too many of us got to know Kurt that well. I didn't know that at the time. I thought that he was conspicuously. I mean, one of the qualities that Kurt had is that he couldn't say something he didn't believe. By the way, that's a fascinating quality. I'm married to a shrink, and we discuss that, you know. Because I can, you know, and she can, and it's interesting. For example, it can be as elementary as going to visit somebody in the hospital room and saying, you look fine. Yeah, you look good, Charlie. Get me here. And somebody would just, Kurt would just nod his head and maybe leave the room. He just couldn't say something, which is very, it's a marvelously paradoxical aspect of a person with such extraordinary imagination, you know, that straightforward manner about everything that he saw and everything he encountered. And because he did not like confrontation at all, so he sort of steered from that. But one of the things that he really had great, great delight in was sport. And he and I played tennis together and ping pong. I've got to tell you the ping pong story, because it's probably one of my two or three classic vignettes. We were playing ping pong, and I don't know, they call it table tennis, but we call it ping pong. And it wasn't easy to find a place. We found this place on Broadway, and we used to go up there and play. And we actually played sort of often enough that we bought paddles and left the paddles there. And the guy who kept the paddles had no reason. And I was on Channel 5 at that time, you know, so people would recognize me. So we both walked in like it was a speakeasy hideaway, because there wasn't anybody else but us, and the guy would look at us and say, here, got your paddles. Total monotone. It's going to be $5. I think you're playing a little longer. You want the table on the left? All right. How many ping pong balls do you want today? What do you say, sir? How many ping pong balls do you want? I said, well, we better give us three. All right. So that was the relationship, and really social, booming through the world. So we would play, and then Kurt came up with the first Vonnegut improvisation. He said, let's play a 100-point game. I said, okay. I said, what's the reason? He said, we always wind up with 3 or 4 points between us, so let's go for 100. We don't have to keep so much math for certain things. So we were playing that 100-point game on a day when two young guys came in and took the table to our right. And they were playing while we were playing. And the hardest part of ping pong for us in those days, we were just at that point where bending down to pick up the ball was getting a little difficult. You know? And out of love for him, because he was very tall, I would pick up the ball more often. I figured he's got further to go. So the ball goes flying, and the guy with the three balls had me all confused that day. I only took two, and we couldn't find one, so we're down to our last ping pong ball. And the ball goes across the room, and this kid picks it up. And I walk over and I say, grab on. He says, yeah. He says, aren't you the guy on Channel 5 television? He said, don't they call you professor? I say, so why are you playing a 100-point ping pong game? And I say, well, actually, it's not my idea. I said, it's my friend Kurt Vonnegut. He said, who's it? And he said, that's Kurt Vonnegut. Another guy comes going and says, that's Kurt Vonnegut. Like they're telling each other. And I said, yeah, that's Kurt Vonnegut. And Kurt's there very quiet, doesn't have a cigarette because he's playing sports. You know, and he's standing there with that nod head. And then the kid says, Mr. Vonnegut, could you autograph this ping pong ball for me? And it was a dramatic moment because it's going to be the end of our day. And Kurt says, okay. He puts down the KV. Somewhere in the world there's a guy with a Kurt Vonnegut ping pong ball. And we wrapped it up. I don't remember the score of the game, but that was the end of it. And you say, well, there you go. That was, I thought, is. I tell you one other one that I love is my wife has written books about sex, and her first book, The Sexual Self, was a huge success. It sent our kids to school and all. And Kurt would always say to me, you get teased about that? And he said, be sure to tell people she learned everything she knows from you. Well, you know, I could never get that out right. You know, it just didn't seem to me, you know, appropriate. It wasn't true, so because, I'm tucking it in my confidence. You know, we both agreed that we were fascinated by pornography. Well, this is a literary organization, and I can tell the truth. And neither one of us had the daring to go to pornographic movies. And they were, do you remember that era? They were all over the joint. And then that guy made that movie, Caligula, I think it was called, right? And it was playing Midtown. You know, everybody looks very interested in this. Look at the changes of expression. And Kurt and I thought, you know, he said, your wife's a sex therapist. You can go. You can just tell me you're doing research. I said, yeah, and you're coming along as my friend. So the two of us decided we'd go to see that movie. As a matter of fact, that movie was not an off Broadway. It was right around Lexington Avenue. We walk in, we go to the movie, and we're watching. I feel like the most sinful man in the history of the world. I mean, my sexuality is going 40,000 different directions. And I'll spend the rest of my life in this movie theater. You've got me. And the movie goes on for about 20 minutes, and then Kurt gets up and walks out. And I get up and walk out, you know, looking over my shoulder right behind him. Then when we get right in front of the theater, he gets off one of those great jujitsu lines. He says, too much of a good thing. got it? I love it. Too much of a good thing. That took care of that. That took care of that one. That was the end of that afternoon. So you've got two of my Vonnegut stories. I think at this point, I think it's time that we should open for questions, right? If there's any questions you want to share with us, we'd be delighted. Or any observations, we make it even broader. Yes, Mr. Thomas Fleming. You all know the distinguished novelist and historian.
I've always wondered about Kurt, and I'd love to hear your opinion. Do you think that coming from the Midwest had something to do with his directness?
With his what?
Sort of baseness and explicit.
Yeah, let him take the first shot at that, because you're a Midwesterner.
Wow, I mean, I was going to say something about that, actually, if I got a chance, because it seems so transparent to me, absolutely yes, that there's a kind of fundamental Midwesternness to the tone and to the lack of artifice. Yeah, I mean,
I love it.
Yeah. Which is so different because, well, it's different from a lot of writing that's generated in the East and West Coast areas, you know. So there's a real decency, politeness, and directness about the voice, I think, that's totally central to what he's doing.
That's absolutely, and he said so himself. I mean, Kurt always said that. I mean, he felt he was a Midwesterner, and this was all just part of the great adventure of New York. New York was, I'm from Baltimore, you know, we call it Balmer, but Baltimore, but Balmer. And I felt the same. I understood that feeling, but not, we discussed that. So you're right on the button with that, Tom. And we decided that Balmer was not comparable to the Midwest. The culture of Balmer was not that different from that story. And what I had not known, I don't know if I've got this right, but at one point, I read it, either heard it, and I mentioned it to Kurt, the largest number of immigrants in this country were from Germany, that there were more German immigrants. Is that true? That the Midwest, and that what was startling is how many people from Baltimore and New York that I knew had no awareness of that. You know, and this is going back through World War II. We knew there was a Bund and there was Rathkellers, but we didn't know the numbers were that overwhelming. It was a very rich culture, and I think he totally did identify with that. Okay, good question. Anybody else have an observation or question you want to share with us? Are we totally intimidated by this thing?
Yeah, it's always the first one that's really hard to get through.
I'll give you one more reflection on his sports, and because I think this is a letter. Am I sharing everything with you? This is a Kurt Vonnegut letter to me in 1981, and it says, Dear Sidney, I really miss you and all the other tennis pals. I'm like Flexner. And I had to read this because Jimmy Flexner was the person who introduced me to this library years ago. And I meet Jimmy, I'm going to make an observation because I don't know if many of you knew him. He was a great American historian about Washington. And also he also wrote about his family and American art. And when Jimmy was no longer at the Frederick Lewis Allen Room, and he came here, invited me here once, and he had that marvelous way of speaking with a flick of his hand, you know. So it's a charming place, he said, and great resources. You may like it here. I didn't know if he was inviting me to join or he was showing off. You know, I was in a total state of bewilderment. And then he got off one of those great flexes. I said, but then again, you write novels. This might not interest you. That was my experience until today. But when we played with Kurt, Jimmy and I had been playing for years together, and we had Harry Jalan and a couple other people. And then Jimmy Flexner, a great historian that he may be, had no awareness of Kurt Vonnegut, except that his daughter told him. She was awed. You're playing tennis with Kurt Vonnegut. And Kurt just loved playing, and he adored Jimmy. And Jimmy kept calling Kurt my friend. He would say, your friend Kurt Vonnegut. It was never Kurt Vonnegut. Your friend Kurt Vonnegut. It was like, you're responsible for this man. And it was okay, because he was my partner a lot, and we won. But that was his phrase. Jimmy wasn't a demon player either. But Kurt loved that group. And in this letter indicates the bonding that took place over all the years. So he goes on to say, I'm like Flexner. You guys are the only friends I have. Now, isn't that a start? I mean, the literary friends were... He said, I'm beginning to wonder if my arm will quit hurting and get strong again the way the sports medicine doctor said it would. You went through the same thing, did you? We all were playing. We weren't that old. I guess we're in our 60s, but like 50s, 60s, in the 60s, early 70s. But we were all cranking her up. And then he has a reflection here, which is off the track of this, and it is a confidence, so don't talk about it, even though you taped it. There was a former writing student of mine whose name was Steve Kunis, who had published a piece, and it was in People magazine, that he and his friend claimed J.D. Salinger had written them a letter, and they were writing a piece about it. And I showed Kurt the letter. Do any of you remember it was a scandal? You do remember it. It was a scandal at the time. And I had no involvement except that this guy Kunis was my student, and he wanted me to get Kurt to verify that. And what do we know about the style? But I did evoke the confession from Kunis, but that's another story. But he refers to it here. He said the Kunis piece seems genuine and even illuminating. See, he it was a sucker punch. This guy was a great mimic of stylist. The kid. All right. He said I was the person, incidentally, who asked J.D. Salinger to sign Catcher in the Rye, and who was refused most angrily. Did you ever tell Kunitz that? Did you know that Salinger wouldn't sign books? And this, he said, I used Salinger's neighbor, the centurion Frank Platt, to sign the book for its wonderful Russian translator, Rita Raitt. Salinger not only refused to sign the book, he stopped speaking to Platt. So those of you who are writing a biography of J.D. Salinger, be sure you mention this in the footnote. Oh, God. I must have told you during our ping-pong days so long ago that Truman Capote said that Salinger had submitted stories regularly to the New Yorker and that the stories which Capote claims to have read are awful. I ask, gotten enough names for your afternoon here? We got one more name and the quote is over? Okay. I asked John Updike if he believed this, and Updike said, he wouldn't surprise if it were true that Salinger was certainly trending towards incomprehensibility. Updike explained over the early stories, saying that they were so juicy. This was a way of suggesting, I think, that Salinger didn't have much of an intellect. Finally, I guess you can't make a career of simply looking. Sooner or later, if you're going to go on writing, you have to put some hard-edged ideas in your mind and believe in them the way you believe in Tinkerbell. Season's greetings and love, Kurt Vonnegut. That's the last of my confessions. I don't know if anybody else. Can we wrap it, or do you want to ask anything else? You satisfied? Shall I read the last poem? Rick, I'm going to just read the last poem, very brief, and then this is another Vonnegut, and you can go home. You had two Vonnegut poems, and you met Rick Moody. Okay. This is called Intelligent. All right, I'll pick that up here. What's that? All right, I'll pick it up at the end. Okay, this is...
I said that's what you wanted to read.
No, I've got it right here. This is very brief. This is a Vonnegut, four-liner. It's called Intelligent Design. Evolution knows exactly what it is doing and why. That's how come we've got giraffes and the clap. Kurt Vonnegut. Try that one. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks again.
A bit of Kurt Vonnegut here in the room tonight, and I think we'll all read his work now with new appreciation and understanding and delight.